All right, so we're diving into a chapter from Orthopedia today.
Orthopedia, yeah.
That's the free peer-reviewed textbook. It's at orthopedia.com, written by Bernstein, Penny, and Vayet.
Great resource.
For sure. And, of course, before you take any test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us.
Read the book.
Absolutely, read the book. But today, what we're zeroing in on is Lyme disease.
Oh, Lyme disease.
Lyme disease. Yeah. It's a pretty fascinating area, especially when we think about it in the context of musculoskeletal medicine, because of the way it can actually manifest as arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be kind of tackling some of the really key questions around Lyme, and we'll be using our notes here. Just make sure we keep things focused and relevant.
Okay, sounds good.
Perfect. So first up, let's just start with the basics. What exactly is Lyme disease?
Well, Lyme disease is a bacterial infection. You get it from the bite of infected blackleg ticks, and often the first sign that you have it is this really distinctive rash that appears at the site of the bite.
Like right where you got bit.
Yeah, right where the tick was.
Wow.
But people can also develop other symptoms, you know, more general symptoms like headaches, fever, muscle aches, and crucially for us, joint pain.
Right. That's where it gets us.
Exactly. And it's this potential to cause arthritis that really makes Lyme disease so relevant in, you know, our world of musculoskeletal medicine.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And while we're primarily focusing on the joint issues today, it's important to remember that Lyme can sometimes lead to even more severe and widespread problems, which we'll, you know, touch on briefly. But our main discussion will keep that centered on the musculoskeletal aspects.
Okay, so Lyme, the name Lyme, where does that come from?
Pretty straightforward, actually. It's named after the town of Lyme, Connecticut.
Oh. Okay.
Which is where the disease was first identified and studied. And, you know, when we look at where Lyme disease is most prevalent, the East Coast definitely has the highest numbers.
Right.
But it's not just limited to the Northeast. It's important to remember that the deer population plays a big role in the spread of Lyme disease because deer are the primary hosts for the adult ticks, and it's these adult ticks that can transmit the bacteria.
So the more deer, the more Lyme.
Yeah, you could think of it that way. And because of this link with deer, Lyme disease has actually been reported in every continental U.S. state, so it's more widespread than many people think.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's not just a Northeast problem. Outside of the Northeast, we also see quite a bit of Lyme disease in the upper Midwest, particularly Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
And also along the West Coast, particularly in Northern California and Oregon.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So we know it's bacterial. What's the specific bacteria that causes Lyme disease?
So the bacterium responsible is a type of spiral-shaped bacteria called a spirochete.
Spirochete, okay.
Yeah. And the most common one that we see is Borrelia burgdorferi.
Right.
But other spirochetes within that Borrelia genus can also cause the illness.
I see.
Now, this is transmitted through the bite of an infected deer tick. And the most common tick species involved is Ixodes scapularis.
Got it.
And if you take a look at figure one in the Orthopedia book, you'll see a photomicrograph of this bacteria, and you'll notice its characteristic corkscrew shape. What's interesting is that this spiral shape actually helps the bacteria move through the tissues of the host.
Really?
Yeah. It's like a built-in drill, allowing it to disseminate and possibly even evade the immune system.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating.
It is.
Okay, so there's this really interesting question in the notes that kind of reframes how we think about Lyme.
Okay.
The question is, Lyme disease is not just an infection, it's an ecosystem in motion. It requires four living organisms to complete its narrative. What does that even mean?
I like that question. It really highlights the complexity of Lyme disease. Mm. It's not just about the bacteria, you know.
No.
You absolutely need all four components for the disease to exist and spread the way it does.
Okay.
So first, obviously, you have the spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi. That's our main culprit. Second, you have the tick, specifically Ixodes scapularis, and this acts as the vector, carrying the bacteria and transmitting it when it bites.
Right, like the delivery system.
Exactly. Then there's the deer. Now, deer aren't actually infected by Borrelia themselves.
Okay.
But they are the primary host for the adult stage of that tick.
So they're important for the tick's life cycle.
Exactly. They're essential for the survival and reproduction of the tick population. Without deer, the ticks wouldn't thrive as well. So fewer ticks, less Lyme disease.
Makes sense.
And finally, the fourth part of this ecosystem is us, humans.
Oh, right.
We are the accidental host. And when an infected tick bites a human and transmits that Borrelia, our body's immune system kicks in.
Right.
And it's actually this inflammatory response that's responsible for many of the symptoms that we see with Lyme disease, including the joint inflammation, the arthritis.
So it's not the bacteria directly causing the problem, but our body's reaction to it.
Precisely.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
It is. And there's this little poem in the notes that I think really summarizes those four elements really well.
Okay, what is it?
It goes, "We fault the bug, but it's not alone." Immediately telling you that Borrelia burgdorferi is just one piece of the puzzle.
Okay, yeah.
And then it continues, "A deer and a tick give it a home." Perfectly illustrating the important roles of the deer and the tick in the transmission cycle.
Right, they're partners in crime.
Yes, exactly. And then the last part, and last, "People too must share the blame. Immune cells set their joints aflame."
Wow, that's actually really clever.
It is, right?
Yeah, it really highlights that the joint inflammation, the arthritis we're talking about, isn't just the bacteria directly attacking the joint, but rather our body's own immune system reacting to the infection.
Absolutely.
Okay, so if someone gets infected, like they've been bitten by this tick carrying Lyme, what's usually the first thing they might notice? Like, what's that initial presentation that might make them think, oh, I might have Lyme disease?
So the classic initial sign is a rash called erythema migrans.
Erythema migrans.
Yeah. And this usually appears anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks after the tick bite.
So not right away.
No, not immediately. And it's important to note that this rash only occurs in about 75% of cases.
Oh, wow. So you could have Lyme and not even know it.
Exactly. Now, when it does appear, the classic description is a bullseye appearance.
Bullseye. Okay.
Yeah, you know, like a target. It starts as a red macule, which is a flat discolored area, or a papule, which is a small raised bump right at the site of the bite.
Mm-hmm.
And then this expands, becoming quite large, at least 5 centimeters in diameter.
Wow, that's big.
It is. And often it develops an area of central clearing, leaving that characteristic ring shape.
Right, like a bullseye.
Exactly, just like what's shown in figure 2 in orthopedia.
Perfect. So we've got figure 1, figure 2.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you said it doesn't always have that bullseye look.
Right. It's also quite common to see a more diffuse red rash without that central clearing.
Okay, so it can vary.
Yeah, it can. And interestingly, despite its sometimes dramatic look, this rash usually isn't very symptomatic. Yeah. People might notice a little bit of warmth where the rash is, but generally it's not itchy or painful like you might see with other rashes or allergic reactions.
Mm, that's interesting.
It is.
Okay, so let's say someone has this potential rash, maybe some early symptoms that feel like the flu.
Okay.
But they don't do anything about it. How does Lyme disease usually progress?
So if left untreated, Lyme disease typically progresses through 3 stages.
Three stages, okay.
Yeah. The first stage, stage 1, happens within the first month after you get infected.
Mm.
And during this stage, people often experience what we call nonspecific symptoms, things like fever, headache, fatigue, kind of like you'd see with a lot of common viral infections.
Right, so not really specific to Lyme.
Exactly, but they might also have muscle aches and stiffness in the neck.
Okay.
Then you move on to stage 2. This occurs weeks to months after that initial tick bite, and this is when the infection can spread to other parts of the body.
Oh, so it's traveling.
Yeah, it's disseminating. This happens in about 20% of people who don't receive treatment early on.
Wow, so it's important to catch it early.
Absolutely. And some of the things that might bring people to the doctor during this stage are facial palsy.
Facial palsy, what's that?
That's a weakness or paralysis of the muscles on one side of the face.
Oh, wow.
Or joint pain that kind of pops up in different areas of the body.
Oh, I see.
And sometimes people in this stage might not even remember having a tick bite or ever seeing that initial rash.
Oh, wow. So it can be kind of sneaky.
Yeah, it can. Now, less commonly, stage 2 can involve even more serious problems like lymphocytic meningitis.
Lymphocytic meningitis, that sounds serious.
Yeah, that's an inflammation of the membranes surrounding the brain and spinal cord. It can be pretty serious.
Wow.
And you can even have cardiac problems.
Like with the heart.
Yeah, like inflammation of the heart muscle.
So it can really affect different parts of the body?
Yeah, it can. And then finally, you have stage 3. This is really where the arthritis comes in.
Okay.
Stage 3 is characterized by recurring episodes of swelling and pain in the joints.
Mm-hmm.
And often, there's an effusion, which means fluid buildup, in the joints.
Okay.
And this usually affects one or a few large joints.
Which ones are most common?
The knee is the most commonly affected.
Okay.
Followed by the shoulder.
Got it. So Lyme disease is not something to take lightly.
No, it's not.
Okay, so we've been talking about this chapter from Orthopedia.
Mm-hmm.
That's the free peer-reviewed textbook at orthopedia.com. It's by Bernstein, Penny, and Vayette.
Great book.
Awesome book. Definitely check it out. But remember, don't rely on us for medical advice. Read the book and consult with a professional.
All right, so let's move on. Let's say someone suspects they might have Lyme disease. How do we actually figure out if they have it? What role do lab studies play?
Lab studies are definitely an important part of the diagnostic process.
Yeah.
And if someone comes in with that classic erythema migrans rash that we talked about,
right,
and they have a history of tick exposure, you know, they were in an area where ticks are common.
That's often enough for a clinical diagnosis, and you might not even need to do any lab testing to start treatment.
Oh, interesting. So the rash can be a pretty good indicator.
Yeah, it can be. But if the rash isn't there or the history of a tick bite isn't clear, then we need to turn to laboratory tests.
Makes sense.
These tests look for antibodies against the Borrelia bacteria in the blood.
Antibodies, okay.
Yeah. The first test we usually do is a sensitive one called the enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, or what we call an ELISA.
ELISA, okay.
Yeah. And a negative ELISA test is actually really helpful because it's very good at ruling out Lyme disease.
So if it's negative, you're pretty much in the clear.
Most likely, yeah.
Okay.
But, and this is super important to understand, a positive ELISA test by itself doesn't necessarily mean that someone has Lyme disease.
Oh, really? Why is that?
Well, about 20% of the general population can have antibodies against Borrelia for various reasons, even if they haven't actually been infected.
So it could be a false positive.
Yeah, it could be. So if the ELISA test comes back positive, we need to do a second, more specific test to confirm the diagnosis.
What kind of test is that?
It's called a Western blot.
Okay.
And this test looks for the presence of very specific antibodies. There are two types we look for: immunoglobulin M antibodies, or IgM, and immunoglobulin G antibodies, which are IgG.
IgM and IgG.
Yeah. IgM antibodies typically show up pretty early after the infection, somewhere between 2 to 4 weeks after you're infected, while IgG antibodies appear later, usually around 4 to 6 weeks after infection.
Got it. So depending on when you get tested, you might see one or both of these antibodies.
Exactly. And in the case of Lyme arthritis, because this tends to be a later manifestation of the disease, patients with Lyme arthritis will almost always have positive IgG antibodies.
Okay, so that's something to look out for.
Definitely.
All right, so let's say we're thinking about Lyme arthritis specifically.
Okay.
What about looking at the joint itself? Is there any value in taking a sample of fluid from the joint and analyzing it?
Yeah, that's a great question. When we suspect Lyme arthritis, doing what we call joint aspiration, basically taking a sample of the fluid from that swollen joint, can be really helpful.
Okay.
But mainly for ruling out other conditions that could be causing similar symptoms.
Oh, I see. So it's more for differential diagnosis.
Exactly.
What kind of things are we trying to rule out?
The main things we want to exclude are gout and septic arthritis, both of which can also cause sudden joint pain and swelling, you know, similar to what we see in Lyme arthritis.
Right, right.
So when we analyze the synovial fluid, that's the fluid in the joint, in Lyme arthritis, we usually find a higher than normal white blood cell count.
White blood cell count.
Oh, yeah, often around 10,000 white blood cells per cubic millimeter. Now, this number is helpful because it tends to be lower than what we see in gout, where the count might be between 20,000 to 50,000.
Okay, so gout has more white blood cells.
Generally, yes. And it's significantly lower than what we'd see in septic arthritis, where the white blood cell count can be over 50,000.
Wow, so that's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, it is. So it helps us distinguish between those conditions.
Right, so if the white blood cell count is really high, that's a red flag for something more serious like septic arthritis.
Exactly. And it's worth noting that trying to culture the fluid, you know, to actually grow the Borrelia burgdorferi in the lab, isn't a very sensitive test.
Oh, okay.
It's hard to grow from joint fluid.
I see.
So we don't rely on that for diagnosis.
Okay, so when you're looking at a patient who has joint pain, what are some key things that help you differentiate between Lyme arthritis and other conditions like septic arthritis or gout? Like, walk me through your thought process.
Sure. So when I'm considering septic arthritis, there's some really clear warning signs.
Like red flags.
Yeah, exactly. Patients with a septic joint, they often can't even put any weight on the affected limb. Their overall white blood cell count in their blood is usually significantly elevated. And as we just talked about, the white blood cell count in the joint fluid itself is typically way higher than what we see in Lyme.
So that's a big clue.
Yeah, it's a big one. Then, when we're thinking about other inflammatory conditions, like rheumatoid arthritis, there's some differences there too. Lyme arthritis often affects just one or a few large joints.
Okay.
And the symptoms can be kind of intermittent. They come and go.
Oh, interesting.
Whereas rheumatoid arthritis is usually a chronic progressive disease.
Meaning it just gets worse over time?
Yeah. It can affect multiple joints, and it often affects joints in a symmetrical pattern.
Oh, so both threads of the body.
Yeah, like both knees or both wrists.
I see.
And then with gout, while the acute pain, that sudden pain, can be very similar to what we see in Lyme arthritis. Usually a joint fluid aspiration will show the characteristic uric acid crystals that are found in gout.
Oh, right. So that makes the diagnosis pretty clear.
Exactly. So those are some of the key things I look for to help differentiate between these conditions.
Okay. So let's say we've gone through all of that and we've arrived at a diagnosis of Lyme arthritis.
Okay.
What are the usual treatment options?
So the standard treatment for Lyme arthritis is a 28-day course of antibiotics.
Okay.
And these are taken by mouth, orally. The most common ones used are doxycycline and amoxicillin.
Right.
However, many experts recommend avoiding doxycycline in children.
Oh, okay. So there are some age considerations.
Yes, definitely. Now, the good news is that if Lyme disease, including Lyme arthritis, is caught early and treated promptly with antibiotics, the outcome is generally very good.
That's reassuring.
Yeah. The infection is usually cured. But for some patients, they might see some improvement with the initial round of antibiotics, but still have some lingering symptoms after they finish the course.
Oh, that's frustrating.
It is. And in those cases, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, suggests considering a second course of the same oral antibiotic.
Okay, so sometimes you need a second round.
Sometimes, yeah. And in addition to antibiotics, we can also use non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs.
NSAIDs, like ibuprofen.
Exactly, like ibuprofen. And these can help manage the pain and inflammation in the affected joint.
Okay, so that's for symptom relief.
Yeah. But generally, we advise against injecting corticosteroids directly into the joint.
Okay.
At least until after that full course of antibiotics is completed.
Got it. So this leads us to a topic that I know generates a lot of discussion and sometimes even controversy, chronic Lyme disease.
Right.
What's the current medical understanding of this?
This is a complex area for sure. As we've talked about, the vast majority of cases of Lyme disease are successfully treated with that course of oral antibiotics. But there are some individuals who continue to report persistent symptoms, things like fatigue, pain, joint and muscle aches, long after they've completed the recommended treatment.
So even after the antibiotics are done?
Yes, even after.
Okay.
And the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, recommends using the term post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome to describe this situation.
Post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, okay.
Yeah, and it's important to understand the NIH's stance on the term chronic Lyme disease.
What is it?
Well, they point out that this term, chronic Lyme disease, has been used to describe a whole range of different illnesses.
Oh, I see.
Including ongoing symptoms in people who did have confirmed Lyme infection in the past, but also symptoms in individuals who don't have any evidence of a current or past Borrelia burgdorferi infection, either from clinical signs or lab tests.
So it's not always clear if the symptoms are actually from Lyme.
Right. And because there isn't a clear medical definition for chronic Lyme disease, and because it can cause a lot of confusion, many experts in the medical community actually don't support using this term at all.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. They emphasize that we need a more precise and evidence-based approach to understanding and addressing persistent symptoms that happen after Lyme treatment.
So it's really about being careful with the language and making sure we're basing our understanding on solid evidence.
Exactly. Now, it's important to acknowledge that some people do experience these long-lasting symptoms.
Yeah.
And research is ongoing to better understand why this happens and what we can do to help those individuals.
That's good to hear. Prevention is always better than treatment. So can Lyme disease be prevented?
Absolutely. And this is a message that I can't stress enough, especially if you live in or visit areas where Lyme disease is common.
Right.
You can significantly reduce your risk by taking some simple precautions to avoid tick bites.
Okay, like what?
Well, obviously, completely avoiding wooded areas and areas with tall grass, especially during the warmer months when ticks are most active. That's not always practical for people who enjoy being outdoors.
Yeah, I love hiking, so I can't just stay inside.
Right. So if you are going to be in those areas, there are things you can do. Using insect repellents that contain DEET or treating your clothing and gear with permethrin, these can help deter ticks.
Okay, so making yourself less appealing to the ticks.
Exactly. But even more importantly, when you're in those high-risk areas, wearing appropriate clothing is key.
What do you mean?
Things like long-sleeved shirts, tucking your shirt into your pants, tucking your pants into your socks.
Oh, so you're really covering up.
Yeah, you're creating a barrier, reducing the amount of exposed skin where ticks can attach.
That makes sense.
Figure 3 in Orthopedia actually shows some common tick attachment sites, so you can get a visual idea of where to focus on covering up.
Oh, that's helpful. So it's all about layers and barriers.
Exactly. And when you come back inside after being outdoors, do a thorough tick check.
Okay.
Pay close attention to areas like your hairline, behind your ears, in skin folds, you know, places where ticks like to hide.
Makes sense.
And taking a shower soon after being outdoors can help wash off any ticks that haven't attached yet.
Oh, good tip.
And of course, if you do find a tick that's attached to your skin, remove it as quickly as possible.
Okay, and there's a right way to do that, right?
Yes, definitely.
So what's the proper technique?
The recommendation is to remove it within 36 hours, ideally as soon as possible.
Okay.
The best way to do it is using a pair of clean, fine-tipped tweezers.
All right.
Figure 4 in Orthopedia actually shows a good illustration of this. And the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, provides really good step-by-step instructions.
Okay, what are they?
So you use the tweezers to grasp the tick as close to the skin's surface as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Then you pull upward with steady, even pressure.
Okay.
Don't twist or jerk the tick.
Oh, why not?
Because that can cause the mouth parts to break off and remain in your skin.
Oh, yuck.
Yeah, not good. So after you've removed the tick, make sure to clean the bite area really well and wash your hands with soap and water or rubbing alcohol.
Got it. So tweezers, steady pressure, and clean afterwards.
Exactly.
And what was that thing about not crushing the tick?
Yeah, never crush a tick with your fingers.
Okay, noted.
Good. All right. So before we wrap up, let's quickly review 5 key terms that we've covered today.
Okay. Sounds good. Little recap.
Yeah. So first up is Borrelia burgdorferi.
Borrelia burgdorferi, the Lyme bacteria.
Yes. Named after Wilhelm Burgdorfer, who played a big role in discovering it. And remember, while the infection itself is caused by the bacteria, the arthritis we often see is more about the body's immune response to this particular spirochete.
Right. Our body's reaction.
Exactly. Okay, next up, we have erythema migrans.
Erythema migrans, the rash.
Yeah, that characteristic bullseye rash, that's often the first sign of Lyme infection.
All right, good one to remember.
Definitely. Third key term, ELISA.
ELISA, that's the blood test, right?
Right, the enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay. This is that initial sensitive blood test we use to help diagnose Lyme disease when the rash isn't there.
Okay, got it.
Fourth term, the 3 stages of Lyme disease.
3 stages, all right.
Yep. Understanding that Lyme disease can progress through those 3 stages, early localized, disseminated, and late disease, is super important for properly managing the condition.
That makes sense.
And finally, our 5th key term, doxycycline.
Doxycycline, one of the antibiotics.
Yes, a commonly prescribed antibiotic and often the first-line treatment for Lyme disease in adults and older children.
Although not for everyone.
Right, not suitable for everyone, especially younger children.
Okay, great recap. So we've been talking about this chapter from one of the best resources out there, Orthopedia.
For sure.
The free peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine. It's written by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vaid, and it's available at orthopedia.com. Absolutely free of charge.
Can't beat that.
Nope. And again, before you take any test or definitely before you treat a patient, don't just rely on us.
Read the book.
Read the book. You'll be glad you did. All right. So for all of you medical students out there listening, think about how this whole interplay between an infectious agent and the body's immune response, it's not unique to Lyme disease.
Right.
There are other conditions in musculoskeletal medicine where infection or even just the suspicion of an infection can trigger some really intense inflammatory responses.
Absolutely.
So exploring those parallels, thinking about how the immune system reacts in different scenarios, that can really deepen your understanding of these complex interactions.
I agree. It's a great way to expand your knowledge.
All right. That's all time we have for today, but thanks for tuning in to this deep dive on Lyme disease. Don't forget to check out Orthopedia and keep those brains engaged.
Until next time.
See ya.